Ladies and gentlemen, can I please have your attention?
From the Duck South Studios in Oxford, Mississippi.
We're mass communicating.
It's a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off for him.
This is the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.
I give it a 10.
Sweep the leg. You have a problem with that?
No, Sensei.
No mercy.
And now, here are your hosts, Rocky LaFleur.
Everybody on? Good.
Great. Grand. Wonderful.
Josh Webb.
Sorry I had a fight in the middle of your Black Panther party.
Jake LaTondres.
I am bad news. I'm going to break you.
Also starring Rob Kroon.
I bet you slice into the woods $100.
Gambling is illegal at Bushwood, sir, and I never slice.
And Bradley Ramsey.
No, Mark, been saved.
Well, that's it, boys. I've been redeemed. The preacher done washed away all my sins and transgressions.
Showtime.
All right, here we go. Hold your ears, folks. It's showtime.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
Welcome to the End of the Line podcast. I'm Rocky LaFleur, and I'm in the mobile studios today with my family as we travel across this great nation. And joining me today is Mr. Bradley Ramsey. Bradley, we're both kind of out there today.
Yeah, you're on the mobile studios. I'm in the temporary Duck Style Studios here in the great city of Hobbs, New Mexico.
I like you inventing a name for it, the temporary Duck Style Studios.
Well, it better not be permanent. I've been out here since May 30th. I hope I get to see home sometime soon.
Well, I thought it'd actually been longer. It just seems like it's been longer than that you've been out there.
Oh, I came home for 3 or 4 days for graduations and all that kind of stuff, but it ain't like I've been home. I came home and did a bunch of dad stuff, which I appreciate, but it was a quick turnaround. I never unpacked my suitcases.
Well, how much longer will you be there? I know that everybody wants me to ask you a question.
Well, the honest answer is I've told my bosses that if I'm not home on the 5th of July through the 8th of July, they need to go ahead and fund my divorce because that's my weekend away with my wife, first time one we've had in probably a year. So I know I'll be home by at least July 5th.
Okay. Well, I want to tell you this. Man, the interview with Martin, woo. Like, you know, you accomplished what you were trying to with that because you were trying to give people, you know, and we talked about it a little bit. You were trying to give people a peek into the relationship with you guys. You allowed them to listen to a phone conversation between two buddies, two hunting buddies.
Well, I'm glad it came off that way, and that really was, I mean, honestly, Martin and I, we text back and forth and keep up with each other a little bit, but we really hadn't talked since duck season. And when, you know how we do these pre-show interviews and talks and stuff like that, and when Martin and I got on the line, we started catching up, said, wait, let's just do this online. Let's catch up once we start recording. And I'm glad it came off well. Martin's a dear friend of mine and somebody whose opinion and trust I respect, you know, a lot and enjoys company. And good hunts are bad. We always have a good time. And he's an interesting fella, and I can't wait to tell the rest of his story or get him to tell the rest of it because it's a good tale. It really is.
Now, listen, I know that those guys duck hunt a lot, of course, and I know that they love crappie fishing. I mean, do they get into deer hunting, turkey hunting, blah, 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 also?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. As long as it's not interfering too much with the duck hunting, of course they do. I think Martin's got a big trip coming up in September for bow hunting out in, I believe it's Wyoming. Can't remember. He mentions it in the podcast. I just don't remember which state he said. But he's a turkey hunter. He's an avid, you know, crappie's his fishing passion, but you know, anything that'll tug on a line, he's gonna go after it. So I mean, they're all around sportsmen. I mean, they do a little bit of everything.
I will say this: you know, this will put to bed a lot of gossip, a lot of rumors. When it comes to the Duck Commander crew, now, I know people that know them, that are good friends with them, you know, and you're friends with some of them. I've always heard that this is the things that I've heard, and you tell me true or false. Jace is a lot quieter in person than he is from the shows.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You know, and I haven't spent that much time around Jace, but, you know, Jace would pretty much rather fade into the crowd than be out front.
Phil Robertson, don't wear your emotions on your sleeves, because you know what? If you ask him a question, he's going to give you an answer. He's going to tell you exactly what he's thinking, so you better not go, like I said, don't wear your emotions on your sleeve when you ask him a question. Is that true or false?
You always know where you stand with Phil, I promise you. You know, he's going to tell you what he thinks, and he'll listen to what you have to say. But if he doesn't agree with you, he's going to let you know.
Willie sometimes is very hard to deal with. I'm not going to say very, but hard to deal with.
You know, that hasn't been my experience. I mean, I've heard some people say that, but, you know, I don't know Willie that well. I knew Willie better many moons ago when I was running the magazine. I haven't spent a lot of time around him in the last few years. Willie is an astute businessman, and his brain is running, you know, 24/7, 365. So he can seem a little bit, you know, distracted or hard to approach, but he's always working. I mean, he is dedicated to his business. And you know how that type A personality is. It can be, you know, it can be a little bit, seem a little distant to some people. But
yeah,
it's not an intention. It's just, you know, he's focused.
See, I get that sometimes too. I get that from people about myself, that I have 9,000 things going on in my brain, and just because you don't, and I'm not comparing myself to him by any means, but sometimes people have told people that I know that, you know, I have 9,000 things going on in my brain. Hey, man, he's just not real nice.
Well, you know, I tell you this, Rock. I was in the Grand Monroe Airport a few months back flying somewhere, and Willie and a couple guys were flying out also, and every single fan I saw come up and approach him, he took the time to shake their hand, listen to what they had to say, take a selfie with them, whatever it was. I was sitting fairly close to him, and I could hear all the business he was trying to do, and he was working with some people, but he never just hid. He didn't shun away from people. He took the time out to shake their hand, to say hello, to tell them how much he appreciated their support, and that, you know. So, I mean, he's a great guy, but he's always got something on his brain. He's always working.
And I understand that. Like I said, I understand how that sometimes can come across. Sometimes my brain works in that same way. Now, I will say this. All right, what's the younger brother's name? I've got my wife sitting here beside me as we travel in the Duck's House Studios. What is the younger brother's name? He's on the show,
Jep,
with him. Jep. Now, I have heard that Jep is like the greatest lab in the world, man. He has no enemies. He is everybody's best friend.
You know, Jep's one of the family members I don't really, I haven't had a lot of interaction with. But that's certainly what I've heard about him, and, you know, that's what he comes across. Just a hail fellow well met. But I can't say from personal experience, and I wouldn't want to paint him with a brush that was made up of fiction.
Yeah, I've just always heard that he's that old loud, Mr. Popularity at school, just a great guy you want to hang around. I've just always heard that from different people about him. And size,
that's
just
my
size.
Understanding of him.
Si, yeah,
Si
is really
100% Si. 100% all the time. Yeah, you know, he's come by a friend of mine's camp a couple times on hunts, and, you know, he's always got a story. He's always got, much like Phil, he's always got an opinion. And, you know, it's no lie. That man walks around with I think he has a tanker truck of tea following him around, because he's always got that jug in his hand.
Let me say this. If I had to pick one person out of all that group to hang out with, you know who I'd choose?
Who's that?
Mountain Man. That's who I would choose. I'm serious. He would get on a lot of people's nerves, but, man, I could hang out with Mountain Man. We could have a good time.
Who knows what the cars may hold? Who knows? Who knows what the future may bring, Rocky?
Mike Bradley, as I travel through central Oklahoma, and as I was on the road all night last night, you actually recorded with Pat Pitt to the water, and it's the story of the waterfowler is what we're calling it. And you guys had a lot go on in that story. How did it go?
It was fantastic. I always enjoy my time talking with Pat. This is the first time I've gotten to spend some time speaking with Patrick as well. And, you know, it's a great part of his story. I know that a lot of these stories we've done have tried to go chronological, but we haven't done that with this because there's some groundwork that needs to be laid, you know, as far as where Pat's world, you know, changed and moved in the whole waterfowling, you know, history. And, you know, Pat may be too humble to admit it, but, you know, he plays a significant role in the history of waterfowling around here, around the world, just because of who he is and who he's interacted with. And so it's a great story. I'm really looking forward to people hearing it and, you know, encourages people to look back into some of the stuff that Pat's done and the people he interacted with and, you know, get to learn a little bit more about why it means so much to have someone like Pat still around and sharing their story with us.
Well, I'm looking forward to listening to it. All right. Well, Bradley, I have got, my wife is poking me. Have you ever eaten at a place called Brahms?
Can't say as I have. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Or do you know yet?
I don't know. My wife is like, I may get a divorce if I don't stop there.
Well, you better get to it.
Yeah. I'm about to pull off of the interstate here as we travel through central Oklahoma and eat at Brahms. So I guess I'll tell you next week how it went. But we need to get to that interview with Pat now. Thank you, Bradley. Have a great rest of the week.
Thank you.
And I'll talk to you later on.
Have a safe trip, man. All right, folks, as you heard in the intro, we're back with another segment of the story of Mr. Pat Pitt, the waterfowler. We've got Mr. Pat and Patrick on the line. Gentlemen, how are y'all?
Doing good.
Doing fine.
Is it as hot there as it is out here in New Mexico?
Yeah,
man, the humidity's really nice, too.
I'm sure. It was 96 here yesterday with no humidity, and boy, it's a different animal.
But it's 88 here today, and I had to go pick up a load of driftwood for taxidermy work, and I was inside a trailer, and it's like a sauna, so, you know.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm going to have to take a shower tonight.
Where'd you go get your driftwood from? You sourcing it yourself, or did you got somebody gathering it for
you? I met a guy that's going to a taxidermy show. I met him down here in Pontotoc, Mississippi, as he was going through. He was delivering a load to a taxidermist there, and I arranged to meet him and went down there and filled my pickup truck full.
Okay. How many birds you got on your list right now for the freezer or ready to go?
I got three I'm fixing to do tomorrow, but I may be under 100 right now if I am, just barely to finish.
Folks don't understand how long it takes to get the kind of work that you do. And there's not a lot of folks that do the quality of work that you do. And I hear people talk about, you know, oh, I can't believe it'll take me a year or whatever to get a bird back. And I'm like, you don't understand what it takes.
Well, I appreciate that, but I mean, you got to understand, if you bring me a duck, there's 100 people in front of you that have already brought one.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's never ending. So I just get used to it, I guess.
Yeah, we do.
I was say, when you take 3 months off to duck hunt and you take a month off to turkey hunt, you know, it kind of adds to that timeline just a little.
I can't believe somebody'd do that.
No. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll come to your defense. If you didn't do that kind of hunting, you wouldn't know how well to pose these birds and what the right scene and setting looks like. So that all adds to the art. That's just research. That's what that is.
Well, that's just being there and doing that and seeing that. And, you know, there's a lot of taxidermists, or maybe I won't say a lot, but there's quite a few taxidermists that don't waterfowl hunt. And, you can tell it in the way they mount. Just like artists, there's a lot of artists that paint a painting from a mounted bird that's got obvious problems, and it transfers to the canvas because they don't get out there with a camera and take pictures of birds actually doing what birds do.
You know, in a mutual or associate of mine, or an acquaintance of mine, but a friend of yours, David Moss. Those kind of the people that can paint and do taxidermy like you do, that don't freeze something, that actually leave it. When you look at it, you see the motion. It doesn't look like, you know, it doesn't look like it's carved in stone. That's someone who's been out there with the birds and knows what it looks like, you know.
I like it when somebody like, you know, Patrick will kill a bird and he'll say, well, mount it sort of like this, and it gives me a little latitude as, you know, I can play with it as I go. And for the most part, he's pretty well satisfied, as are my clients, too. Of course, he gets a hell of a deal on them, too, though.
He gets that family discount, huh?
Family discount. Fix the roof, work on the bird pen. You know, it's not just free. There's usually some labor involved somehow.
Yeah, change a U-joint out on my truck and that sort of thing. But, it all adds up and evens out.
Yep, it all evens out.
Yeah, like my father told me a long time ago, no matter what aspect of duck hunting you're trying to think about, don't ever try to calculate the dollars and cents on it. You'd be better off just setting money on fire.
I
tried to convince Gail at one time that, you know, when I'd kill a reward man, I'd give her the check and say, look, I'm making money duck hunting. And she's way too smart to believe that. So.
What's the highest dollar reward band you've seen, Mr. Pat?
$100.
$100.
Yeah, you hear people talk. Do what?
Was that the highest they did? I know they experimented with different price points at one stage.
I never heard of one above $100. You know, myself personally. I mean, I've killed them from all the way from $10 to $100. I think Patrick got yours on the goose was $100, wasn't it?
Yeah. I know when they were doing that, they did like $10, $20, $50, and then $100 to see if, you know, where they thought the breaking point was on what it would take to get that return. If $10 was worth it, or was $20 worth it, or whatever. And I don't know if they ever went above. You know, there was a big a big stink about $1 million bird or something to that effect, that it was that was pushed privately, but that got nixed real quick.
I was hired to be their writer, and I got mixed up in that mess at a young age as well.
That would have made every duck hunter in the world an outlaw, you know. The ones that weren't already. I mean, it would have been.
Well, you know, and it also would have messed up the science, you know, and that's what stopped it, was, you know, finding out that it, you know, look, we actually know about how many bands people report, and if a lot more start being reported, then all of our formulas go wrong, and we can't figure out what we're actually looking at.
Right. Well, they determined that reward bands were reported at a higher percentage than, you know, just regular bands. I know people that would take banded geese and crush the bands in with aluminum cans just to keep from reporting them, because they thought if somebody found out they were killing too many, they would get arrested. But I mean, you know, it's just, there's a lot of
I've run into those folks before, that they don't want to be honest about their hip surveys, or don't want to report bands because they think it's going to mess up something. And so often, though, those are the same people that complain about the science is no good. It's like, well, you're not helping it any.
Nope.
Exactly right.
Nope. Yeah, exactly.
Well, look, I'm gonna back us up a little bit here. I wanna talk about something that's near and dear to my heart, and I know it's a big part of Mr. Pat's story. But Mr. Pat, you became friends with Dr. Andrews. But for the folks that don't know who Dr. Andrews was and his part in the history of our duck hunting and your life as well, could you back us up a little bit and give us a little history on who Dr. Andrews was and take us to the point where you met him?
Well, Dr. Andrews all his friends called him Chubby. I called him Doc. I mean, just because I had a hard time calling somebody older than I was by a nickname. But he was a surgeon in Memphis. He was a scratch golfer. He was a avid tennis player and racquetball player. He was a brilliant man that got every bit of something out of a day that he could possibly do. He was a friend of Nash Buckingham's, and Nash was kind of like Doc's mentor, even though Dr. Andrews' family, you know, were some of the founders of the Beaver Dam Club. But Mr. Buck kind of took Doc under his wing, and as Mr. Buck got older, you know, Doc took care of him, kind of like I'm hoping my boys will take care of me. But when I moved to Memphis in 1971, and I didn't know Dr. Andrews from Adam's house cat, but I happened to live next door in an apartment with a girl that lived next door, was engaged to Dr. Chubb's nephew. And One day in passing, while we were all sitting around drinking a beer and on the back porch or something, she said, "You need to meet my fiance's uncle, Dr. Andrews." And I still didn't know who he was. And I said, "Well, how come?" He said, "Well, he's got some ducks mounted and he hunts a lot." And so I got the phone book out and looked up his address, and he lived over Overton Park right there near the zoo. So I just rode over there one day, walked up, knocked on the door. And, you know, his wife came to the door, Margie, bless her heart, and they were just fixing to sit down and eat supper. Of course, I didn't look at a watch, half the time didn't wear one. They invited me in for supper, and, you know, I was introduced to Doc and Rad and Bill Andrews, his son, and Steve and Nancy, his daughter, and sat down there and ate supper with them.
Still not knowing who he was.
Yeah, not knowing. I mean, just right out of the blue. It's, you know, "Hi, I don't know you, but I'd like to see all your stuff you got." Well, he had a room, good-sized room with, you know, just ducks and whatnot everywhere, and that's how I met him and how we got acquainted. I mean, it wasn't just bumping into him on the street. It was premeditated, but, you know, I was accepted like, you know, I was one of his children, and it just got stronger and stronger.
Mr. Pat, at what point did you realize who he was in relation to Nash Buckingham and Beaver Dam and that?
Well, when I got in there and, you know, looking around, I'm looking at pictures of him and Mr. Buck and him and Mr. Buck and him and Mr. Buck in a that little Alumacraft ducker that Mr. Buck had, and them paddling here and there, and, you know, standing over in a corner with Bo Whoop 2.
Wow.
I'm thinking, this is cool. And I had heard of Beaver Dam, but I didn't realize Beaver Dam was such an enigma of anything that I had ever thought of as far as duck hunting. And so, you know, it was like, "Well, we need to go down there and duck hunt. You know, you need to come with me sometime." And so it got to the point that, you know, he was off every Thursday. Whatever classes I had, if I was either late or I cut, we'd duck hunt every Thursday and Saturday at Beaver Dam. Likely as not, I'd drive his car so he could catch up on some sleep, because he's burning the candle at both ends. And, you know, we'd go down there to hunt in the morning and come back, and likely as not, one night a week, we'd mount a bird in his basement, because he was an avid taxidermist, and he was showing me. I've still got the first duck I ever mounted with Chubb.
Really? What species is it?
A ruddy duck, and I mean, it looks like homemade sin, but it means the world to me.
That's where your fascination with taxidermy got started? That's where your hands got wet, as it were, in taxidermy?
Well,
with Dr. Andrews?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a Northwest School of Taxidermy or anything else. I mean, I knew some taxidermists that did birds, and I'd save up my money and get a duck mounted every now and then. But I started piddling with it in 71 or 72, I guess. And even in as late as 79, when I first went to Alaska, my taxidermy bill cost more than the trip did. So I figured I better get serious about it. And Doc worked with me and helped me and you know, kept pushing me because he always, you know, strive for perfection. And it just, you know, snowballed from that. I tell people it's a hobby that got out of hand, but it, you know, helps pay the bills. I mean, I remember charging people $40 to mount a duck for just so I could get to practice. But, you know, it's...
I'm going to back you up again, Mr. Pat. Tell me a little bit about your trips down there to Beaver Dam. I mean, what was the set and setting compared to, you know, give me one of your favorite stories and memories from that.
Well, I'll give you one of my favorite ones, but Beaver Dam then is not even close to the way Beaver Dam is now, because the buckbrush and the button willows and the sawgrass, all of it was just alive and vibrant. That was before they had all the high water and the cormorants and whatnot that killed everything. But
sure.
It was like being in church, paddling through those big cypress trees and getting up into Round Pond, for instance. I'd read about Round Pond even when I lived in Chattanooga and you know, reading Mr. Buck's stories. And a typical morning, we'd load up, be a couple of boats, and there were several blinds up in the north ends where we usually hunted. Somebody'd go to hand worker with several people, and some of us go to Doc's pool, and some of us go to Round Pond. And, you know, of course, that was point system, and we were, you know, gosh, you were killing a lot of gadwalls down there, widgeon, a little bit of everything. But long about one of my favorite story probably is... Long about 8:30, 9 o'clock, when we were getting close to a limit, you know, Doc would show up and had a little Lemacraft ducker, and he'd say, "Come on, son," and he'd call everybody son. I mean, "Come on, son, get in. Let's paddle down the west side and jump shoot, and then they can pull us back across the lake when we get even with the dock." Well, I knew exactly what was going on. One, he didn't want to pick up a decoys, and I didn't blame him because I didn't want to either, and left the guys up there to do that. But we'd paddle through the cypress and the buckbrush, button willows and whatnot, and jump shoot ducks. And our target was always a place called Usry Pocket. And the pool in Usry Pocket was, Dave Moss couldn't have painted a better picture of a duck hole. It was surrounded by sawgrass. Little trail went back up there in it, and I was sitting on the back of the ducker paddling, and Doc was on a milk crate, and you know, we'd head into Usry Pocket, and you know, a lot of times they'd be some ducks, a lot of times they'd be a lot of ducks, and it was just almost like waiting on Christmas getting in that pocket, because you'd push through the last little bit of sawgrass, and you know, boom, you were right in there and amongst them, and the birds were coming up, you know, out of the pool itself, and then out of the sawgrass, and you know, you'd empty out, and you'd always have sleepers coming up, but you know, if you could load quick enough. So my job was to get us in the pocket without banging a paddle on the side of the boat before we got there, and then kick the boat sideways, actually to our left, where since we were right-handed shooters, so we could swing better. But one day, and now understand, Dr. Andrews couldn't swim. I mean,
oh really?
He couldn't swim. I mean, it just blew my mind. I think that's the only thing he couldn't do. But he couldn't swim. He couldn't swim. So we hit the pocket, and I mean, it just literally exploded with birds, and Doc shooting OA5, and he had two birds falling before I could even clear leather. And I killed a mallard drake on my first shot, and it took me two shots to kill a widgeon. He had killed his third bird, and I was reloading, and I think he killed a sleeper coming up. And I couldn't, there wasn't another target for me. And about that time, back to our left, hard left, a black duck came out of the out of the sawgrass. And Patrick can tell you what I think about black ducks because I cut my teeth on them. The only thing I could do, I stood up in that little ducker, and I don't know if you know what one looks like or not, but, you know, it's bathtub with training wheels. I stood up in that ducker and put one foot on the gunwale so I could swing and kill that black duck. Well, Doc about had a fit. I mean, we were in 2 feet of water, but that didn't matter. I mean, we could have been in the middle Atlantic Ocean, and he, you know, it was, son, you could have turned this, I mean, and just, and he, I think that's the maddest he ever got at me for, and I was trying to say, well, Doc, it was a black duck. Yeah, but it, and I mean, he just on. And we finally paddled up all the slain, as he would call it, and picked them up, and picked up that black duck last, and he reached down, picked it up, and he said, well, it is a nice one. And then that smile came back on his face, and all was well. But, gosh, we had such good times, you know, down there. Just either, you know, duck hunting or brim fishing or crappie fishing or frog gigging or just whatever, you know, the mood struck us. It was like something I'd never experienced. And he shared it with me, just like I was one of his own children. Losing Doc when he died was as bad as me losing my father.
He passed in, what, 2005 or no? Earlier than that, didn't he?
Yeah, I think it may have been a little earlier than that. I'd have to go look. But I know, you know, we used to take him with us in Arkansas, and one of the best hunts we had on an opening day in Arkansas, he was with us. And, I mean, you know, it was so meaningful to have him with us. And he was a very religious man, too, of course. He was a deacon or an elder in the church and a lay preacher. And there wasn't anything he couldn't do, I don't think, except swim. He couldn't swim. So, and he let me know. He let me know that he couldn't. But I'd have still shot that black duck if I'd have known he couldn't swim.
Patrick, did you ever get to hunt with him?
I did get to hunt with him a few times. I never got to hunt Beaver Dam with him. That's the only thing that I don't guess I didn't get to do. Did make a couple fishing trips down there with him, but I never did get to hunt. But he hunted our club with us a couple of times, and Doc is the only man that my dad has ever waited on when he was running late, ever. He won't even wait on me and Steven, but he waited on Doc one time. Dad and I got to have a real fun shoot with him on Charlie Berry's farm there in Tunica one time, shooting sculp. But the hunt Dad was talking about opening morning in Arkansas, we killed, there were five of us in the pit. We killed, 10 redheads before we shot another. And actually had to, you know, of course, with the two duck limit on redheads, we had to quit shooting them. I don't know where they were coming from, and you know, we kill them occasionally, but that morning we just pounded on them, and then the greenheads turned on, and we finished out a limit with greenheads, except Doc couldn't lay off the greenwing tail, and he killed one or two, and Dad was poking at him about, you know, shooting them instead of greenheads, to finish out, the tail hit the decoys, and Doc pulled up and shot once and killed two of them. And that's what we needed to kill. But that's what we needed to finish our limit was two ducks. And all he could do was look at Dad and smile. And we unloaded our guns and back to the truck we went. But Doc was always real fun to hunt with. Always had a smile on his face. You know, always encouraging. You know, like Dad said, very devout Christian man. Always had. Always had Jesus on his mind and in his heart, and he was just incredible to be around.
Well, yeah, I'm going to back up a little bit because there's something that you mentioned in your favorite story there, Mr. Pat, about, you know, going and jump shooting, and having read a lot of the Buckingham stories, if not all of them, you know, people get very caught up in the idea of, you know, we have to Yeah, the old timers always decoyed their birds, but jump shooting was a big part of beaver dam. That was a it was part of what they did.
That little Lumacraft ducker was, it was like a stealth fighter. You could ease through 3 or 4 inches of water. It was just an incredible little. It was a stable little boat, considering. But it was as more a part of decoying ducks. Now you knew you were going to decoy ducks, but you never knew what you were going to kill jump shooting down. And we jump shoot down the west side. Sometimes we'd go all the way down to Teal Hole. Just depended on how many birds we needed and how the day was going. But I can remember we got almost down to Teal Hole on the south end of the lake, and there was a little open water blind out there. And Doc said, "Well, there's some decoys in it. Let's get in the blind." Well, I had my Chesapeake with me, Jake, in the boat with us. That was pretty good load. The opening is about the size of a bathtub. But, we paddled out to the blind, and I put Jake up on the platform. Doc got in the blind, and he put a sack of, old Herder's Model 63 canvasback decoys. I paddled out there and put a dozen of them out, and sitting there on the open lake, and there were some birds flying. And, about the time it sounded like a jet coming down the lake, and there was a flock of cans that came down the lake and saw those decoys, and they wheeled and caught the wind. And, it was as pretty as a picture. And I understand this is when canvasbacks were 100-pointers, okay? So they rolled up in there, and there was probably, 2 dozen maybe. And Doc said, when they got right, I'm talking about those big old feet drop down, he said, "Pick out a Drake." And we stood up, and each shot one time and killed 6. I don't mean crippled off 3 or 4. I mean we killed 6 outright dead. And I swear that the Drake I shot didn't have another bird with him, so I blame Doc for the other 5. And he wouldn't have none of that either. So I can remember, he said, "Well, the Lord made them decoy, and the Lord's going to make us pick them up." So, I sent the dog, and he picked up all 6 birds. And we paddled all the way back to the clubhouse with them, not to mention the ducks we already had in the boat. So, accidents happen, but, like Doc said, "Well, the Lord will forgive us because we don't do that all the time." Yes, sir.
Well, and a lot of respect for someone that can do that and not try to hide it, not stomp something in the mud. It happened.
No, he would never do that. I've told a game warden to his face, and I'm sure Patrick was there at the time, that, you're going to get me over the limit before you get me stomping one in the mud. I said, "I'm going to bring it out of the field." He said, "Well, coons got to eat too." I said, "Well, they're not going to eat one the dog's bad to bring you one on the way out of a field that's a cripple or if you're not paying attention." So I don't know. It's all part of it. It happened
many times. When we have, much like your club, where you don't use four-wheelers, we have a club that we hunt over in Louisiana that you can drive the four-wheelers to the main intersections, but the pits are in the levees way out in the field. And so when you come out, you're coming by intersections on other fields. And sometimes four-wheeler's too loaded with people, and the dog just got to run. And many times we've been coming out with a limit, and the dog bails off into the ditch and picks up a cripple.
Yep.
And we're taking it back with us. That's just part of the game, And well, I'd rather take the ticket.
I would. I'm not going to waste one. It's disrespectful to the resource. Just like I hate to see somebody wring a duck's neck, too. That just gets up against me because it's disrespectful for what we're hunting, I think. If you can't figure out a way to kill one without making his neck 2 feet long, he shouldn't be out there. But that's just me. But I was going to say, the guys at the club, they've learned not to do that.
Right.
Makes for an ugly picture, too.
It does, and no matter what you try to do to twist one's head back around and make it look right, when you're trying to pose one up like that, it doesn't ever look right. It doesn't.
You know, if you don't want to bite the head, which is real simple, I don't mean chew a hole in it, just crack the skull, or just put it on the bench and put your heel of your hand on it, or put it under your leg and just sit on it. It'll smother itself.
Yeah.
And this goofy little thing that they call the eradicator, if I wish somebody'd get eradicated with one of them where the sun don't shine, because they don't help a bird when it comes to taxidermy, poking that big hole in the back of the head.
Yeah, I was going to say, some of that dispatching of birds can't make it any easier on you on your taxidermy world.
Well, no, because the worst place you want a hole is the head.
Right.
I mean, it just, you know, I've always said, you know, somebody come up with bottomland rubber dog do, a hunter's going to buy it just because it's in vogue, I guess. But I don't know. I just learned to respect the resource probably more so now than I ever have.
When you were hunting Beaver Dam, you're talking about paddling in there. Was there a no motor rule on the lake, or was that just how y'all decided to operate?
Used to when Mr. Buck hunted it, they had paddlers, you know, like Horace, you've read about him.
Oh, yes.
They didn't have motors, but it wasn't until... And it was before I started hunting there that they started using motors. And I'm not talking about big motors. I'm talking, you know, something you can carry in one hand, you know, a little four-horse or something that sit on the back of the boat. And likely as not, one motor on a boat would tow another boat plus the ducker. I mean, it wouldn't, you know, look like a ski festival out there like Tunica or some of the others when you hunt, but it was a gradual thing. But most of the time, you know, they wouldn't motor all the way into the hole. They'd just stop and then offload into a boat that didn't have a motor and paddle on up in there. That's what I try to establish at our club. I mean, you know, guys want to ride a four-wheeler to the pit. Well, you got ducks out there spending the night, or you got ducks in the buck brush spending the night. You know, that's a rude awakening for them. Something come blazing out there with Q-beams and motors and, you know, slinging mud and everything else. I think it's detrimental. Plus, you know, it's lazy. And I tell people, you know, hey, I'm almost 71 years old. If I can walk to the pit, you can. You know, we've made exceptions when it comes. Last year when Patrick and took Mary Claire duck hunting Thanksgiving, he walked her to the pit, and she's not even 4 years old yet. I mean, she was...
Wow.
Stephen carried Reed out there on his shoulders like I used to carry them when they were young. I don't know.
Something else I noticed on about taking ATVs to pits. When I've done a fair bit of flying with some pilot biologists and with some friends with small aircraft, and on pits where people take their ATV out there, the ruts that go to that pit to me look like flashing arrow signs pointing at that blind, because those ruts stay muddy longer than the field water stays muddy. I guess because the turbulence isn't settling them out.
Yeah.
But when you fly over a pit blind and you've got ATV tracks going in there, they're all like arrows pointing straight to that pit blind. And I got to believe a duck will notice it. Places with those ruts like that, I get shot at. Maybe they're not that smart, but it stands out to me when I see it from there.
Well, I've goose hunted in Oregon with a guy that he'd walk all the way around a field to keep from making footprints in the dew across a ryegrass field to where the goose spread was set up.
I know folks like that for sure.
Yeah, and I don't like, well, another, you know, farmers don't like their fields rutted up, because if they're going from rice to beans or beans to rice, it takes longer for those ruts to dry out, you know,
sure.
Even if they, you know, pull a harrow across everything. But I just do it out of respect for the ducks and respect for the farmers. You know,
well, that goes a long way.
Well, I mean, you got to keep, farmers got the gold and they make the rules. I mean, you got to keep them happy. If they say no four-wheelers, fine. If they say no hunting past 12 o'clock, that's fine. If you don't like it, go try to find somewhere else where you can kill ducks.
Well, and especially when you've had a relationship with a farmer as long as you have there, you know, you don't want to, you know, those kind of long-standing relationships, they're worth whatever it takes to put into them effort-wise to maintain them. Because you know that land, you know that property, you know how it hunts. If you had to move your operation somewhere completely different, it's a huge investment of time and energy and knowledge to have the kind of history on a place that you have there.
Well, and there's a lot of give and take, too. I mean, you know, if a farmer says, well, I think we're going to have to go up on this or we're going to have to do that, you know, what are you going to do? You're not going to stand there and argue with him. But, I mean, you know, you're going to keep an even keel about everything. And you got to realize duck hunting is the most expensive small game sport there is, by and large.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's, you know, the old joke, you know, how to become a millionaire. Get $1 billion and start out duck hunting. You know, it'll run you down to $1 million in a hurry. So,
I had a friend tell me that he said he's an avid waterfowler, and he says, you know, when I finally grow up, I think I'm going to be an upland bird hunter, because all you need is a pocket full of shells, a good pair of boots, and one dog, and mm-hmm. you're outfitted. That's it.
Yep.
And good knees.
Good knees, so, yeah.
Which I don't have.
Well, we don't have time to get into it tonight, but I want to lead towards this. In your relationship with Dr. Andrews, you got to shoot Bullwhoop too, I understand.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Doc had just about a full case, and I'm not talking about a flat. I'm talking a 20-box case of
right. The
last shells. John Olin would always send Mr. Buck a couple of cases of shells each year. Mr. Buck's favorite load was 1 3/8 ounce in a 3-inch compression form of Winchester hull of copper plated fours. I've still got some of the shells. It says 4L for Lubloy. And, you know, they were, like I say, they were 3-inch shells. And when Doc and I'd go to Beaver Dam during the week normally, if he was going to let us carry Bullwhoop, he'd get 2 boxes of those shells, and we'd each shoot a box of them, or until we got a limit or whatever. Now, I'm going to tell you, Bullwhoop 2, I haven't been able to shoulder Bullwhoop 1. I know Mike Boyd has, and he and I have talked about it. But Bullwhoop 2, to me, was like pointing a rail fence. It didn't fit me that well. But he said Bullwhoop 1 is quite different. But, you know, of course, gun, big old heavy long barrel, double barrel gun. I mean, it was ponderous, I guess, the swing of thing.
30-inch so, double full, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was full and full, or full and fuller. I don't know, but I'm going to tell you what, if you get to tracking a bird, if I get a bird coming at me, I don't care if he's 20 yards or 50 yards, chances are I'm going to kill him. But we'd shoot birds off the top of those cypress trees just because Mr. Buck liked to. I mean,
right.
We wouldn't sit there and skybus and whatnot. I mean, we'd kill ducks with it. But, you know, gosh, I'd swing on a duck, and it just absolutely crush them when you hit them. I mean, you know, it just boom, splat, and spinning them around and everything else. Now, you get a bunch of blackjacks in the decoys, you feel kind of awkward with swinging that thing. But once you got it moving, it was going to keep going. But, you know, I really am blessed to have been able to do that. And, you know, when I'd kill a duck, and, you know, I'm not the greatest wing shot in the world. Don't, you know, say I am. I've killed a lot of ducks, but I've hunted a lot. But when I'd kill a duck, it was, you know, that even impressed Doc. With this gun, he'd always give Mr. Buck credit for it because, say, Mr. Buck's hand was guiding that gun. You know that, don't you, son? And I say, yeah, Doc. I said, but it sure was a good feeling. So,
oh, absolutely. I can't, you know, there's a big difference between the words jealousy and envy, and I envy you that. I would not take it away from you. I'd love to experience myself, but even for me, just knowing you as I do, you know, through the world of waterfowling, to know someone who knew Dr. Andrews and who's had the honor of shooting that gun and in that place, it means a lot to me, because that history goes back so far. And, you know, as we talked about pre-show, you know, the chance of losing these kind of contacts, it's just not worth it. You know, we it's one thing to read Mr. Buckingham's writing, but to hear someone who's handled the gun, who's handled the shells, who's hunted with the man who hunted with him. And I understand also, Mr. Patch, you have a hat pin that was handed down to you that was Nash Buckingham's.
Yeah, the Nilo hat pin, which is Nilo Kennels, or John Olin's kennel, where King Buck, you know, came from at Cotton Pershaw, trained. You know, he won the national, I think, twice. But anyway, I always admired Dr. Andrews' hat pin. It's got a picture of, or an image of Maynard Reese's picture of King Buck. It was on the duck stamp, 1956, I think. And anyway, he had the one that Mr. Buck wore on his hat, and he gave it to me. And I've still got it. I still wear it on my hunting hat. You know, it of course, it means a lot to me. I mean, it's still my link, you know, to Doc and to the legacy of Mr. Buckingham. And luckily, I was able to meet the son of one of the, I think he was a caretaker of Nilo Kennels, that got me two more of the hat pins, and I was able to get one to each one of my boys. So,
fantastic.
They've got them. I mean, they're a collector's item. They're made out of German silver and wouldn't part with it for the world. But
of course not.
You know, that was a thrill for him to just put it in my hand and say, "Here, Mr. Buck, probably like to have you have this." So,
it's crazy. But I sit there and get choked up when I hear something like that. I just, you know, what a fantastic part of our history.
I'm rarely at a loss for words, but I've, you know, that really was a surprise coming from him. And I hate myself for not keeping one of the shell boxes. You know, we'd rip the tops off of them and grab a handful. I think I've got one, maybe two shells left. I've got hundreds, if not thousands, of old paper shells and vintage stuff, shell boxes and whatnot. And I know exactly where that one is. I need to point it out to Patrick so he'll know.
Well, be sure to do that. I mean, like I said in the pre-show, I hope you're around for many, many, many moons to come. But, you know, what you're doing to teach your sons the importance of our sport and our shared tradition, you know, and I know it means the world to them, or Patrick wouldn't be kneeling Rocky and I to make you get your story told and to record this. And
yeah, he can be a pain in the ass sometimes.
Keep being a pain.
I'm trying, it's marching the right place.
We need to keep this stuff. We need to keep stuff going.
I really enjoyed starting this podcast. I'm glad that we all got together on it, like you say, because you know, he's got a world of information to spill out, and I hope we can drag it out of him. So,
well, we're gonna do our part, and I'm sure you're gonna continue doing yours.
Yep.
I'll do my best. You know, now that I'm retired, it seems like I got all the time in the world, but I don't. I got birds to mount, or I got a mountain of decoys out here we're going through, or I got this or I got that. And, you know, I'm trying to stretch this as far as I can and get as much out of it as I can. And I always, Gail said something to me after the last podcast. You know, she said, you need to call Stephen and Patrick your sons. I said, yeah, I know they're my sons. Everybody else does too, but they're always going to be my boys. I mean, you know, no disrespect, but they're my boys. And I appreciate the fact that they've turned into great fathers, husbands, and sons. I never once had a knock on the door with a guy wearing a badge saying, "Mr. Pitt, we need to talk to you about one of your boys." So they've never really disappointed.
Well, Patrick, you think y'all are past that stage now? You think he's going to rest easy? That's not going to happen.
We should be. But, you know, I've got two little girls, and they haven't reached the dating age yet, so there's always possibility that something could change.
Absolutely. Having two daughters myself, I can understand how that, the, you know, it could turn at one stage or the other.
Yeah. Well,
gentlemen, I'm going to have to wrap it up there. I want to thank y'all again for being here. I really do. I don't know that I'll get to be on every one of these with y'all, but when Rocky offered me the opportunity to come in here with y'all this evening, I jumped at it. And I know everybody is enjoying this series, and I'm looking forward to the rest of it.
You're welcome. We've enjoyed it, too.
Yeah, it's nice to be able to sit and talk ducks. I mean, that's about the only thing I'm really intelligent about. So,
well, we'll do
it
again
as long
soon.
As you'll have me.
We will do it again soon. And I want to thank all of you for listening to this edition of the End of the Line podcast, powered by DuckSouth.com.